Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It was a weird thing to stand in a hospital room, not a real hospital, obviously, but some poor person, another actor, is lying on a gurney having a heart attack, and I'm there holding them and basically having an orgasm while they're having a heart attack. That's a weird thing to go into work to do.
Hello, and welcome to Black Mirror Cracked, the podcast for all your Black Mirror needs. My name's Sachandrika, and I'll be your host. Today, we have one of the stars of the stories in Black Museum. We have Daniel LePayne, who played the ill-fated Dr. Peter Dawson. So he's going to Skype in and talk to us about removing his teeth for art, and he says the word orgasm quite a lot as well. So here we go.
You know, because we wanted it to look authentic without, you know, but also horrific, but without being sort of over the top as well. But God, where do we start? Let's go back to Doug. I mean, I think Doug had a really hard job, but we all sort of hit the ground running with this. There wasn't a lot of prep time, which I think is a testament to the team who put it together, because it looks brilliant. But often in TV, you don't get a lot of, you know, lead up time. And in this one, I think, especially we didn't have all that long, but so I think Doug sort of, as I said, you know, we hit the ground running, and Doug had this huge sort of, not only the part but sort of the journey and sort of just understanding this whole four different worlds he had to sort of inhabit. So I think my stuff, as crazy as it sounds, was sort of fairly straightforward, even though it was obviously insane and out there. But, you know, in terms of the storytelling, I think was sort of pretty straightforward. So I think Doug and I just sort of mutually agreed that we would have fun and sort of try and make it as clear and do the best job that we could, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's just your classic storyline lifted from a Doctor's episode in many ways. Like...
yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's a story about, I mean, although he's a doctor, it's a story about addiction, I think. And, you know, and I mean, it's great for, you know, as an actor, because you get to go on this sort of massive roller coaster journey in a very short amount of time. So, I mean, for me, the most important thing was sort of plotting, you know, getting from the beginning to the end and sort of all the bits in between. And so, you know, I mean, sort of, I did the normal things I would do as an actor when you prepare for a part, but this sort of was like, I mean, it was always a question for me of how extreme I could take it. And I remember saying to the director, Colin McCarthy, I said, when we first spoke about doing it, I said, I'm just going to go for it, and you just have to tell me when it's too much. Because that's all you can really do, I think. You have to sort of throw yourself in there, I think.
I think it's because it starts off with someone who seems, you know, like a doctor, like someone normal and someone we can understand. And it goes, like, it ends on a really cartoonish note and a very Black Mirror note.
Yeah, yeah. But, a Brooker-esque moment, yes. I think, at the end.
Yeah.
If that's a word, I don't know, maybe we can invent that as a verb or a noun.
And just the pan down the bed when it's like the smile on the face. And you're like, oh, I forgot, Like, it felt like a throwback to the Channel 4 episodes. It felt like it wasn't on Netflix, like an American audience.
Right, exactly.
It's,
and I won't tell you what was under that sheet. But yeah, no, it was definitely Charlie's sense of humor coming through, which was great. I thought it was a really sort of funny, clever way to end it. But yeah, you start to question how much of it is real. But it sort of doesn't matter for the audience whether it's real or not. But it's the relish and the enjoyment of telling those sort of twisted stories that is what makes Rollo such a great character, I think, and what makes the audience sort of love hate him, I think, as well, you know. But yeah, no, it was great to be sort of a part of his, you know, twisted mind and sort of, you know, be a part of that sort of journey and story as well.
what's it like to get your second Black Mirror script? Because I've done my research and actually rewatched, because the entire history of you is like up there as a favourite episode. And I rewatched it and I was like, thank God I did this now, rather than talking to you and being like, oh, is this the first time you've, you know, thank God I
did that. Yeah, I didn't know that it was such a big, I didn't feel like it was such a big deal until sort of I was made aware of the whole sort of Easter egg thing and, you know, things repeating and stuff. And so for me, as an actor, you know, you're a bit of a mercenary. You sort of, you know, you jump in and do, you know, different jobs here and there. But I sort of didn't realize that that would mean something to certain members of the audience and that people maybe would try and read into that as well. And I sort of ended up asking Charlie, I was like, am I the same guy that I was? Like, is there any sort of, you know, resonance? And anyway, so I won't tell you his answer, but it's great. I mean, it was very flattering to be asked back into the family again.
Tell us the answer. Go on, what did he say?
I sort of quite like the idea that it was somehow the same sort of guy doing a different job, living in a different country. But anyway, because I like the idea that it's all, you know, part of one universe, you know, the Black Mirror world is sort of, you know, which I think is why Black Museum is such an interesting episode, because it feels like it's sort of, you know, it feels like you're somehow, you know, that the world is sort of contained within that world or that episode. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you guys are probably a bit more clued in about sort of what's going on and the repetition of stuff and Easter eggs and all that sort of stuff. I'm not maybe so up to date on that stuff.
So you're watching TV and that kind of recurring story of the dead weather girl,
right?
Which, you know, it's really important. Yes. And someone somehow has got some Blade Runner zoom in going and they can read the little ticker bit.
I love that. I love that.
My laptop wouldn't do that. But
So what was it? What was the ticket? Is it relating to another episode?
Yeah, they always ask that. Yeah, Johnny Brooker uses, because, you know, his background of screen wipe and being kind of satirical TV columnist, he always uses those news tickers. He satirizes news, which I think is part of why there's a lot of fans here in the Daily Mail news stream. So I can't remember that exact one, but I think possibly Cookies of Rights.
So he's so brilliant and he thinks everything through. Even though, what was I saying? No, even though, you know, the stuff that I was asked to do was really extreme. You know, as an actor, you don't mind if it's for someone like Charlie, because he's so at the top of his game and he's such a sort of detailed and brilliant storyteller that you actually feel like you're in safe hands when you're working with him, even though you might have to do such extreme things. You know, as an actor, you don't mind because you know that he's got the whole sort of world in his head and he's got it all worked out down to the very smallest detail.
Is he there on set quite a lot?
They were sort of bodding about, but he lets the director and us and everyone do their job, you know, which I think is also great, because he knows he's there as a presence, but you know, it's nice to have him there, and you know, he's sort of very much in the background, but you know, he also knows when to sort of step back and let the people he's employed sort of get on with it and do their job. Him and Annabelle, yeah. So, which again is great, because you feel safe and you feel like you can, you know, supported and able to do your job.
What did you think when you got this script then? And did you have sort of the ending to it? And was it all there on the page? Or was this
it was all there on the page? And I have to say, it was the stage direction, I can't remember the exact wording, but he orgasms and feels her orgasm at the same time. That was the clinch. I was like, wow, okay, if I can do that. I've never read a stage direction in a script like that before, but if I can get away with that, then, you know, this is something I really want to have a go at.
Yeah, and it almost goes in a really positive way when it goes down that avenue, and then it kind of turns back and gets worse again and gets scary.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why it's such a great little sort of, I mean, it's only a mini little story, but there's so many twists and turns in it that make it, you know, it's a roller coaster. You know, it's over quickly, but you feel like you've sort of been put through the ringer. And you were talking about the fans before, you know, people noticing stuff and Easter eggs, and a lot of people have commented to me about, oh, you're in that other episode, and what does that mean that you're in this one? So the other thing that makes me laugh is so many people have pointed out, because my name is La Payne, that the casting of me as the Payne Doctor is some sort of meta comment.
being in safe hands with Charlie Brooker, because this is a really intense role. Yeah. It's going to be a memorable image of Dr. Dawson in front of the mirror, and you kind of see the tooth go, oh my God. It's great though. So what's it like seeing the script and then getting to play it? It's kind of a dream.
Oh, it's great. I mean, yeah, it is a dream. I mean, Charlie and the director, Colin McCarthy, they're big fans of this other show I do, Catastrophe.
I don't know if you've seen it. Your character is a terror.
He's a terror, yeah. But so I think they quite like the extremities to which I went in that, and sort of just decided to see if they could take that even further. Which I'm more than happy to do. And as I was saying before, when, you know, as an actor, when you're in good hands, you it makes you want to sort of go for it. And God, I mean, when else do you get the chance to do that sort of extreme sort of storytelling? As I said, like, you know, Charlie's such a brilliant, you know, weaver of tales. And so more than happy to slice my face into bits and get my kid off and jump into bed and drill tramps through the head in a back alley.
How did you prepare for that element of the role?
for the sort of latter half of it. Well, I don't know. I guess you can't really prepare for that sort of stuff. You just have to.
That's what you tell the police.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the point is I think I may have said earlier is that, you know, I mean, he's an addict, so I was sort of, you know, rather than thinking about the specifics of the story, just thinking about how extreme sort of addict's behavior is, you know, whether it's they're addicted to drugs or pain or whatever, how far people go, you know. So I think there's, you know, it was sort of a metaphor for all of that as well. So, you know, and I think I may have said to you earlier as well, what I said to the director was, I mean, you can't afford to be polite or overthink it as well as an actor. You just have to, sometimes you just have to throw yourself out there and trust the director's going to pull you back if you start making too much of a fool of yourself. But having said that, you have to be prepared to make a bit of a fool of yourself as well.
What's a shame is that the doctor character obviously starts somewhere that we can understand and then morally goes through the window.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he's having his own dilemmas at work. You know, he's sort of losing people. And I think, you know, he Rollo picks on him because he's vulnerable. He's not someone, he's not at the top of his game. Dawson is, you know, he's having a little existential crisis and you know he's losing people on the floor and I think, you know, and it's probably maybe his job's in danger, you know. I can't quite remember the specifics of what we talked about or what's in the script, but I always sort of got the point that I always sort of had the idea that, you know, when we meet him, he's someone who's looking for an escape or an answer or help, you know. And I think Rollo preys on that with him as well. But yeah, you know, again, you know, the sort of the people wade into sort of experiments, and I think, you know, healthcare is a really good metaphor for that. People wade into sort of trials and doing things that without sort of thinking through the, you know, the repercussions of it. I think, you know, without getting too heavy about it all, I think it's such a sort of, you know, medical tech is a whole other area, you know, that I think they're exploring that in that episode too.
I think also with medicine comes the horror of a state you can't reverse. So comas come up a lot, like twice in Black Museum and in other episodes. And communication, so being locked out of human contact, communication. It's certainly in the next story, which is really heartbreaking with Jack and Carrie in that coma.
Yeah.
And what sort of kind of got me was when she was in that coma, she had that green and red light system that was really simple. It was a huge breakthrough, and she could communicate. And actually being like a monkey is actually the same state at the end of the day. It's just forever.
I think it's the same thing that sort of I was saying before, is like, you know, that you know that we think, and in many ways it does, technology offers us, you know, a way to sort of break through barriers, but in a way, you know, often it just sets up more barriers between us, you know. And, you know, I mean, it's just all sort of, I don't think Charlie's trying to sort of give any answers, but I think it's sort of setting up a lot of questions, and it's really important to question it, I think, you know, whether it's whatever sort of tech, you know, to sort of for everyone to have a philosophical argument about it, because it is such a huge part of all our lives now. And I think, you know, when you make a drama out of it, make a horror story out of it, or, you know, those three stories, I think it's a really good way of having that discussion, because you see on Twitter, you know, everyone's sort of weighing in, and, you know, sort of, it's a really good way, rather than reading a very sort of dry medical document or an article in the newspaper or something, it's a way to engage people and have that conversation. I think that's one of the great things about the show as well as it's sort of, you know, great storytelling and all that sort of stuff. I think it sort of makes a generation of people sort of stop and think, which that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, it takes huge dilemmas and dramatizes them, and yeah, even on quite small levels. So talking about Hang the DJ, so that dating app, you could have made it tap, 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 swipe, 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 just like Tinder or something. But actually, it becomes a conversation between the coach voice and whoever's holding it. So he tends to dramatize all of our interaction with these devices and make it so the audience can watch.
And also, I mean, the thing that I liked about the story I was in was that it starts out as this really great thing. Oh, my God, we've got this amazing tech and we can do this thing. And, you know, and it's, you know, it is in terms of the drug metaphor. It's like, oh, I've just taken this drug. It's working beautifully. It's, you know, I'm seeing the world for, you know, the way I've never seen it before. But there is a point where, you know, everything has an equal and opposite reaction. And I think that Dawson story sort of tells that really well, where there comes a point where a line is crossed and suddenly, you know, you can start heading the other way. And it's the same with tech. You know, when iPhones and first came out, I remember thinking, everyone thinking, this is the greatest thing ever. But, you know, that they're also, along with the good, there's the bad as well, you know. And I think, again, that's what I loved about our story, is that it starts off as this sort of, you know, breakthrough sort of invention, but it does eventually come back to bite him in the face. I was going to say on the arse, but on the face.
Yeah, it's not subtle about the repercussions.
No.
It's also a story about the dangers, which I never thought of like complete empathy. There's a difference between sympathy and empathy, and going all the way into empathy actually means you can't act and you can't do your job, which might be a doctor, it might be the person in charge of the tech, but a responsible job, you can't do it anymore because your mind's sort of been taken over.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you don't, I mean, I think there has to be, you know, I think, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like any profession that helps people, there has to be a sort of healthy distance. And I think, again, you know, like he's so, that doctor is so sort of submerged with his patients that it blinds him to, you know, he stops wanting to help people and starts just, you know, wanting to help himself, basically. You have to keep certain things at an arm's length, otherwise you go mad. And I think because he doesn't, because of the implant, because he's right in there experiencing everything along with the patients, he does go mad. You know, I think, you know, that healthy distance sort of disappears and gets twisted. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's fascinating that, you know, these sort of metaphorical sort of little fairy tales that Charlie tells, and they work on so many, have so many layers to them, and there's so much sort of depth to them. And you can take them as a great story, like a thriller or a horror story or a, you know, whatever it is, or you can start to dissect it and see that there's actually a lot going on beneath the surface, which again I think is why so many people love the show without maybe even sort of realizing why.
I think that's really true, and actually it's like dissecting the story with you is making me think the second story is also about a lack of boundaries between two people. So the moment Carrie's injected into Jack's head, you think, well, he's never having another girlfriend now, because that is insane. And then when she starts calling it our hands, he doesn't wash his hands after having a wee. And she says our hands, which is such a everyone who's been in a relationship, whichever side you've been on, you're like, yes, I've had that moment.
Exactly.
So annoying.
exactly. And again, that's a story that starts off really well, like things are going brilliantly in the beginning, but again, you know, for every force there's an equal and opposite reaction, you know. So I think it's they're sort of cautionary tales in that way, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, don't put all your faith into this one thing, or don't let it go running and leave it, maybe.
Yes, because... exactly. No, exactly. Yeah, and that sort of human interaction is more complicated. That technology is not just going to solve everything with an implant or a, you know, whatever it is. That it's actually much sort of more complicated than that.
Your implant, literally, it's like a energy saving bulb. It's like the biggest one.
It's old school. I'm sure when they make them, you know, in terms of the Black Mirror world now, they're much neater. But I know it's like this massive stud, sort of sewn into the sort of like a drill bit inserted into the side of my neck.
That's very brave. Yeah, you're a pioneer.
Yeah, I'm a pioneer. Sometimes you got to, you know, look foolish in order to pave the way. And I love, you know, it's got a little blinking light as well. When every time there's sort of, you know, a bit of sort of action or feeling going on, this little red light sort of blinks. But yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it's hilarious. And I think they really wanted, you know, for it to be visible, for it to be there in terms of the story, that it wasn't something that was sort of hidden away. I think it was important that the audience could see it and see, you know, and sort of be aware of it, even subconsciously, that it was always there.
There's something a bit Frankenstein's monster about it.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's different to all the other ones, where it's a little disc on the table.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit sort of bit cumbersome. And yeah, it's one of those things when you look back at, you know, the first mobile phones, you go, oh my God, they were so huge. And, you know, that's probably the idea, was that they would look back at that and go, oh my God, I can't believe how big it was. But, yeah, no, it's great. And again, in terms of the production, the attention to detail that the designers and everyone puts in, and the thought that they all put into every element is, you know, it's so worth it, because people really do notice that sort of stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's why, again, it's such a great show to work on, because when people sort of care that much about it, then, you know, you know you're onto a winner.
I think, and also there's a difference. You go from your story to the second one, and already the tech has changed.
It's changed, yeah. Yeah, so exactly. And I think that's sort of, that's that little tour of the Black Museum that Rollo gives, where he sort of, you know, like there's a sequence and a growth between each of the stories as they develop and stuff. I think that's also really clever. You know, sort of the older exhibits in the museum as opposed to the newer ones.
You feel the passage of time between those stories.
Yeah.
I think he mentioned, Douglas Hodge mentioned, his clothes become like more and more dilapidated.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, he's a younger man. Like in that very first story, he's recounting a sort of time when he was younger as well, and his, you know, his past and his history as well. So I think that's really clever as well.
So what did you think of the last story, the ending, which is difficult and complicated, but kind of satisfying to a certain extent?
Yeah, I thought it was really touching. I thought, are you talking about Nish and her dad?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that was really, I thought it was beautifully sort of handled. And yeah, I thought it was really sort of clever, but also very sort of moving. And I thought all the performances were brilliant in that. And it's very satisfying as an ending, you know, all that stuff with her getting in the car and sort of how that all sort of plays out. But I think, you know, in terms of it being a story of revenge and her relationship with her dad, and, you know, I thought that was all just handled, because, you know, it wasn't just clever, it was also very moving, I thought, which is a difficult thing to pull off.
And a bit more moving and more fair than other Black Mirror judgments thing, because this is quite like White Christmas with a three-part story, and you have to watch the two stories to understand the last one, which I love as a structure. It's so clever. But in White Christmas, you feel that Rafe Spall's character gets quite a harsh sentence.
Right.
Because he's kind of left there forever listening to I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day. Whereas there's an element of... she deserves a good ending. Her mum's sort of there in her head.
Who, Nish?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, and it's why, you know, it's sort of rounds. I mean, it's so cleverly done. Yeah, exactly. She does deserve a good ending, and especially when we realise what's happened to her and her family and stuff, and how he's exploited it. How, you know, this man has sort of exploited people's suffering in order to, you know, for his own fame and his own money, and you know, and it's great to sort of see someone like that get their comeuppance. I think
you see at the end how monstrous he is. Like, she has been orphaned almost as a direct result of all of this.
Yeah, of his. I know, it's terrible. But you know, again with Black Mirror, it's you know, all of this stuff, which is why it makes it so scary, and you know, all of this stuff, as we know, could just be around the corner. So it's not like it's these extreme, it's not, you know, Game of Thrones, it's not something sort of extreme and otherworldly. It's of this world, but yet in a sort of, you know, it's a world that we can all sort of envision.
Just going back to season one, what was it like getting that script and working on the entire history of you?
Yeah, I just thought it was really clever. I didn't really know much about the show, obviously, because it was season one. And I just thought, I mean, I didn't have a lot to do in that, and normally probably wouldn't have done a part like that because there wasn't a lot to do there for me. But because I loved the script and thought it was so clever and was dealing with stuff that I'd thought about, you know, those sort of things that we all think about. And, you know, Toby Kebbell's a great actor and stuff. So, you know, I mean, I was sort of happy to do it, but I didn't really know very much about the world of Black Mirror, because I'm not sure whether any of them had... Were they standalone episodes at first, or...?
I think I'm imagining none of them would have come out.
Maybe not. Yeah, and then I saw... And then I did that, and I didn't really know what it was I was doing, but sort of thought, wow, this is a really good story. And then when I saw the pig one with Rory Kinnear, I can't remember what that one was called.
It's the National Anthem.
Yeah, I thought, okay, this is pretty damn good. And I mean, as I said, even though like I'm only sort of in it for a second, but it's still sort of bizarrely something that so many people sort of refer to, because so many people watch Black Mirror. It's really good as far as I remember that episode, you know, and it sort of feels again like it's sort of got technology that might just be around the corner if it hasn't already arrived.
It was a different
story. Different, but also just, you know, smart and clever, and no one had done that thing where you go, God, yeah, this is someone's dealing with this shit that we're all sort of trying to navigate, this new world that, you know, we all sort of are obsessed with and talk about, but no one's really sort of managed to put it up on screen in a way that, you know, speaks to us as clearly and asks so many questions, you know. And that's why it's so special, I think. And people have tried, and people try and do sort of tech-based TV, and it just doesn't, it's not as successful, I don't think, for whatever reason. I don't know, because it doesn't ring true somehow. But these even when they're, you know, USS Callister and out of space, they still ring true. They still sort of, they're rooted in a reality that, you know, we can relate to, I think.
I think people, you start with people who are from our world, or just 15 minutes to the future, I think it's called.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't react in crazy ways. I think the exception could be Dr. Dawson, who seems to react in very exaggerated ways. But then he has the earliest kind of implant, and it has a big like its effect wasn't to gently get you to empathise more with the patients. It was feel their pain and find it somewhere in you, which is a very big. It's going to have big acting around it. Like, someone's a heart attack, you're not sitting there going, it's a heart attack.
No, I know. That was, you're going to be like, quite hard. It was hard to do, I have to say. It was quite sort of, when we were filming it, I'm now remembering when we were filming it, it's quite exposing to sort of, it was a weird thing to stand in a hospital room, not a real hospital, obviously, but some poor person, another actor, is lying on a gurney having a heart attack, and I'm there holding them and basically having an orgasm while they're having a heart attack. That's a weird thing to go into work to do.
It's awkward. It's awkward.
But I sort of, again, because you trust the team around you and you know that it's Black Mirror, you just go, oh, I've got to go for it. And I've got to just, you know, you can't hold back and you can't be polite and you can't worry about what people think. You just have to sort of do it. And yeah, that was an odd day at work. I remember this poor man sort of, I think it was the senator. He was having his sort of, he'd been poisoned and he was in the throes of sort of pain. And I'm sort of there sort of groaning and moaning and just getting off on it. That was odd, I have to say. But sort of funny and sort of fun at the same time. Remember Doug Hodge, going back to Doug Hodge, because we hadn't been in sort of those scenes together, him standing on the other side of the bed sort of looking at me as I was sort of rolling my eyes back and throwing my head back and looking at him going, is what I'm doing, is it mad and stupid? And he said, no, it's great, keep going. So I remember that day very well, and he sort of gave me the courage to keep going for it and not apologising.
I think that it has to be a big piece of acting to make us believe that someone can go from empathy to cruelty, because you enjoy it, because no one's a villain, and I'm sure as an actor, that's, you have to go into every story like that, no matter who you play in it.
Yeah, I mean, again, like I said to you before, it's like he's a drug addict, you know, and he is getting off on his drug, which is, you know, this implant thing that getting off on other people's pain and their pleasure as well. And that's sort of the only way I could sort of make it real in my head, at least, was, you know, and drug addicts, you know, like addiction can make people do really extreme things, and you know, and I don't know, do you know what I mean? Like it's not a sort of polite state of affairs. People climb the walls to, you know, get a hit, and that's sort of, you know, that's what I saw him as, basically.
It could be both acting out of character or really revealing of the character. And it feels like in this case, he became someone else. He wasn't this person originally.
Right. Well, that's what drugs do to your kids.
That is the message of this podcast in every episode. We're never pro-drugs. But interestingly, I spoke to the lead of Playtest a couple of days ago, so Wyatt Russell, and Playtest in season 3, it's a gaming one. And it's,
I haven't
immersive.
Seen that, yeah.
I'll try not to spoil it. It's a horror kind of thing, and I find it hard to watch. But it's like a drug trip. And
it's
like this immersive technology that is a bit like leaving your body and leaving your consciousness and going on this ride.
Yeah.
It's just that, unfortunately, Dr. Dawson, he doesn't get to get off it.
He doesn't. But, you know, I mean, I think there's probably, like what we were talking about before, metaphors for addiction with tech as well. You know, I mean, I don't want to read too much into it, but you know, and sort of the, you know, I mean, they say, you know, that checking, that getting a sort of Twitter notification is releases the same chemicals in the brain as opiates. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, I think these worlds are all sort of crossing over into each other, and I think, you know, again, without sort of wanting to be too extreme about it, I think, you know, that's the world we're exploring, I think, as well.
Well, actually, with Facebook have recently sort of changed how much news they're going to put on their feed, which affects us as a news organisation. They've also said that there is something addictive about behaviour on a mobile phone, reading Facebook feeds and other feeds.
Yeah.
It's true. So it's kind of the work we put out as well, a feed.
Yeah, and did you hear about the text neck as well, which is all these people with really bad neck problems from texting, and that they're all having to see chiropractors, and it's an actual condition now they've called text neck.
Exactly. We're being ruined.
Exactly. The one that Ron Howard's daughter was in.
Oh, Nosedive. Yeah.
Is that the one where you Nosedive. Rate people?
Yeah, and I was discussing this with Gina, who's the voice of Coach, and she was like, oh, it's like, you know, Uber ratings. I never want
yeah,
to know
it
mine.
Is.
And that's why you can look at yours. You can look it up on your phone.
I don't want to know. Though. I wanted my teenage daughter to watch that. I sort of had watched it and then said, you've got to watch this, thinking that it would completely change her sort of, you know, awareness of social media. She thought it was great, but I don't think it changed very much. But there you go. At least, you know, at least it sort of prompted a discussion. God, I feel for them having to navigate that world. You know, it's tough, you know, and it's, you know, like I was saying before, it's addictive, and it's, you know, releases different chemicals in the brain, even though we don't realize it at the time. And it's, you know, it takes a great deal of self-restraint and willpower to pull yourself out of the sort of rabbit hole of of social media, especially.
Any kids your daughter's age, any of their parents not give them a phone at, what, 10 years old? Like, they have to have a phone. You have to.
Yeah, we sort of held off. My poor daughter had one of those Nokia bricks for, you know, for a while. And but I think, no, I think it's getting younger. I think parents are giving their kids phones much younger. And I think, I don't know what the figures are on that, but, you know, because it's also a sort of instant babysitter for people when kids start getting restless. If you, you know, put a screen in front of them, it'll, you know, calm them down a bit.
It's like that video of this 2-year-old girl. It's a couple of years old now, and she's doing a Zoom thing on a magazine.
On a magazine. Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? I'm trying to work out why the image isn't changing. Yeah,
human beings are amazing, but that is terrifying.
Yeah.
And on that subject, I think Be Right Back is probably the one that I keep returning to in my mind, and so that's the one just after the entire history of you, when Donald Wilson comes back from the dead.
I haven't seen that, no.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay. I won't say any more about that. But social media plays a part, and it's about grief, really, which I think a lot of Black Mirror is about. It's about loss, and the human instinct is, I want it back, but actually that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Putting old people in the cloud. Wasn't that the line from... one of them, exactly. But anyway, it was great fun to do as well, and you know, I think we were so lucky with the cast, and I just loved it. I had a great time doing it, and it was an honor and a joy to be there, even stripped naked and my face hacked to bits.
Well, you know, did you not get into acting to go to places you would never experience yourself?
Exactly. But I didn't think I'd ever have to do that.
I think it'll be one of the images of the series, is that slow pan from what is he doing to the mirror, and you're like, Jesus!
And then the tooth. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You have one of the best horror scenes ever, so... Lucky you.
Lucky me.
Yeah, well done. But I think we've solved all of Black Mirror now.
I think we have. Great to sort of, dissect it like this. And, you know, I know it's a show that has a lot of fans, and it's, you know, I think it's, as I said before, it's such a great way of everyone engaging in this conversation about, you know, technology and what it means, and, you know, how it sort of, is potentially going to affect all of our lives and how it is affecting our lives. So I'm glad to be part of that conversation.
It's nice that people are coming up to you and saying they even remember you from the earlier episode. It sticks with people.
Hang on, what about all my other bloody work?
Have you had much work since you removed all the teeth?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's say I've been doing a lot of voiceovers since then.
So thanks to Daniela Payne for Skyping in to talk to us about playing Dr. Peter Dawson in Black Museum. So if you enjoyed our podcast today, please rate, review, subscribe, click all the stars, come up with some smoke signals to tell the world how much you enjoyed it, draw a very large cross on an old pirate treasure map and lead people to it, because the more you do all of these things, the more other people can find this podcast and enjoy it too. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.